You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
T. Boone Pickens has made headlines for his smart investments in corporate takeovers, but now he's making news with his new energy plan. He writes about both his career and the Pickens plan in his book, The First Billion is the Hardest, Reflections on a Life of Comebacks and America's Energy Future. It's published by Crown Business, and I'm pleased to welcome T. Boone Pickens to the show today. Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
You wrote another memoir, Boone, in 1987. Why did you decide that this was the time to write another?
Well, I'd had so much happen in my life from 1987 to 2008, 20 years, and so it was seemed like it was appropriate to go again.
A whole new career with BP Capital.
BP Capital was a whole career, but from 87 to 96, I was still with Mesa, and then in 96 I left and formed BP Capital. But then I got into, you know, my energy plan that I've worked on, the Pickens plan, and that plan goes into great detail in chapters 7, 8, and 13 in the book. So I wrote the book, so anybody that buys it, they need to know that it's not a ghostwriter.
It's not as sold to.
Another thing is that when they buy it, the proceeds of the book go to Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas, and to the Fisher House, which is the homes that the families of people in the VA hospitals go to and stay at no cost. So I don't get anything from the book, which is good. It goes for a good cause.
You write about the influence of your parents and your grandmother on you. Did they teach you the lessons that you've used in business?
Well, they really did. It was a very tight family, and it was a small family. It was my grandmother, my aunt, and my cousin. My aunt and grandmother were widows, and then my mother and my father. So there were two children. One was 5 years older than I was, and then there were four adults. And so that was the total of the family. And they gave me some great parenting, and it was almost perfect childhood.
What about the Boonisms that you've sprinkled throughout the book, like don't rush the monkey and you'll see a better show, or in a deal between friends there's no place for a Wolverine? Did they say things like that?
They didn't. Those didn't come from them. Those were things that happened in my life. But there are some Boonisms there. The one that stands out is the one that when my dad told me after I'd been in college 2 years and he didn't think I was doing very good. He said, son, said, you better get a plan. He said, a fool with a plan can beat a genius with no plan.
Hmm.
And that came from him. But some of them did, and some of them just in, different contexts and things that happened in my life.
And some of them we can't say on the air.
No, that's right.
But you studied geology, and then you started off your career working for one of the big oil companies, Phillips. Why did you dislike working there so much?
Well, I'm not big on bureaucracies, and I had actually worked 3 summers for the Santa Fe Railroad, so I had some experience with the bureaucracy there, and I knew after I got into the Phillips deal that I wasn't going to be there very long.
And do some of the same problems you saw at Phillips plague big oil today?
Oh, sure. The peak oil is, it's here. We have to live with it. But it's actually, we're dealing with a finite resource, and oil is, we're producing it at a rate of 85 million barrels a day in the world, and it's depleting is what's happening.
But you did try to take over Phillips at one point, didn't you?
Yes, in 1985.
So that you couldn't have hated it that much, or maybe you hated them so much you wanted to go in there and tell them how to do it right.
Well, some of that. My father worked for Phillips, too, and I was always disappointed in the retirement benefits that he had. I thought they were pretty skimpy. And I don't know, I thought I could do a better job than the CEO that was running Phillips.
Well, as I said, you studied to be a geologist, so where did you learn the management skills? Are these things that you just picked up as you went along?
Just picked them up as I went along. That's exactly what I did.
You chronicle your hostile takeover attempts of some of the major oil companies. I assume that made you rather unpopular with people in the business?
Well, it did. It in the large oil company area, it made them very uneasy because they thought, well, if Boone can do this, then, you know, it could happen to us too. And so they didn't like what I was doing. But I made a lot of friends from the stockholders.
Hmm. And you got a lot of praise after your unsuccessful bid to buy out Gulf Oil.
Oh, yeah, that was the one where I should have probably not tried it again, because Gulf was very much a success, and you came out of it kind of like a folk hero.
Well, the people in Wall Street loved you because the stock had been so undervalued.
Well, Wall Street liked me on it, those that were in on the deal on either side of the deal, because you were creating huge fees for them.
Well, why were these big oil companies like Gulf, Unocal, Phillips vulnerable to your attempts to take them over? Was it a matter of bad management?
That was it. I mean, the management had not done much for the shareholders. Most of the managements in these companies owned practically no stock at all in them. And so they were, you know, it was a very nice place for them to, you know, park their, I guess, their rears every day and go to the office. And they were like, you know, fiefdoms is kind of the way they were operated.
But even though you failed to take them over, you made money on them. Would you have actually done less well if you had succeeded in taking over one of those companies?
No, if we'd taken it over, I promise you I could have done a better job managing the company than the CEO that I would have replaced.
I'm talking to T. Boone Pickens. His book, The First Billion is the Hardest, Reflections on a Life of Comebacks in America's Energy Future, published by Crown Business. You also say during your discussion of the oil crisis in 1973, giving the good old boys of big oil excess cash flow is like handing a rabbit a head of lettuce for safekeeping. You think that's still true today at a time when the oil companies are again making record profits?
Well, no, I think now that you know, some of my efforts and some things that happened after that, I went into the kind of the post-World War II period of major oil company managements, and those have been retired, they're gone, and you have a different situation now. And I think our oil companies today are much better run than they were back in the 80s.
Why did you decide to leave Mesa 40 years after you founded the company?
Well, we had distributed to the shareholders most of the equity in the company in the form of dividends. We had distributed $1.2 billion to the shareholders, and we got overextended when we did that. I thought natural gas prices would come up faster than they did. They didn't, and consequently, well, it was a we got our dress over our head, and so we had to go out and get some equity into the company. And when we did, it was time for me to step down. But I was ready to do that because I wasn't going to work for anybody again. I wasn't kicked out. It was a case that it was very clear that I would not stay. We'd find a new CEO, and I would go on down the road. And that's what happened. Thank God that's the way it worked, because it worked pretty good for me.
Because you went down the road and started BP Capital, which is not a regular oil company. Did people sometimes get confused because your initials are the same as British Petroleum's?
No, I thought they copied that from me.
That's why they call themselves BP?
Yeah.
The company started with six people. was that just an added part of the challenge?
I didn't understand that question.
Well, you just, you know, you really were starting very small after you had been real big with Mesa.
Oh, yeah, we did. We started over with six people. But I'm notorious for not having a lot of people. And, you know, as big as BP Capital got, we never had over 25 people.
When you were in your late 60s, you were diagnosed with clinical depression. Had you been depressed for a long time? Were you aware of it?
No, I wasn't aware of it. And kind of, I think, sort of just ratcheted into it. Over several years, and things didn't go too well from about 91 to 96. And so you had about 5 years of kind of tough going. And but I did finally figure out, you know, what my situation was. And actually, I was medicated for a short period of time, like 30, 60 days, and a lot of things started changing at that time. So, and I can rebound very well, and so I got, you know, got some breaks and things started working, and I got well right quick.
Well, in retrospect, have you figured out what triggered the depression? There's usually something that starts it.
I think it was just my own, you know, my own problems in business, and also I had a marriage that wasn't very good.
You were getting a divorce at the time.
Yeah.
Well, how do you carry on a successful business while you're fighting off a bout of depression?
That what?
How do you carry on a successful business while you're fighting off depression?
Well, you know, I always I get up early and I work out, and that helps you. And when you're in that, when you have that kind of problem, but I never missed workouts, and I continue to do that. Continue to go to the office, and all, and you know, just work your way through it.
And I would suspect that you might describe yourself as a workaholic.
Well, some people describe me that way. I like to say I love to work. So,
we've seen gas prices fall almost 50% from their all-time high earlier this summer, due in part to a fall in demand. Do you think these low prices are temporary?
No, I don't, because I think the OPEC nations will go ahead and cut supply and support the price, move it back up, and I think within a year from now we'll be back above $100 a barrel.
And what about the economic downturn? Has that changed the energy market?
It has to some extent, no question. It's changed everything, I think. And we see, you know, a tough 2009 ahead of us, and coming out of it in 2010.
Well, in a little while we'll talk about the Pickens plan, but do you think that the economic downturn affects the Pickens plan?
No, I don't think so, because you're still importing almost 70% of the crude oil you use every day, regardless of what price it is. And if you look at the yo-yo effect, is what I like to call it, you had a yo-yo effect in the 70s, and when you had the embargo, you had oil prices run up. Then they ran down, and then in the 80s, you had the same thing in 86, and ran up, ran down. In 90, you also experienced the same problem. And so we've seen, but always the trend is up. Never do you take the lows down to the lowest level that they were previous.
Although it is interesting that in all those earlier crises, or at least the first one I remember, we were told that oil was running out, and that was one of the reasons the prices went up. And then there was an oil glut, and prices went back down. So how much of the market is manipulated?
Well, the people with the oil can certainly manipulate the market, but they do it rather publicly. They'll tell you when they're going to cut supply, and when they cut supply, well, it's tightens it up and the price goes up. They watch inventories very closely. They don't want any inventory buildup anywhere, and so they work very hard on adjusting inventories, which is a market manipulation.
We'll take a little break and come back with more from T. Boone Pickens. His book, The First Billion, is the hardest reflections on a life of comebacks and America's energy future. It is published by Crown Business. Stay with us. We're back with T. Boone Pickens. His book, The First Billion, is the hardest reflections on a life of comebacks and America's energy future. Is published by Crown Business. How did you devise the Pickens plan?
Well, you know, that came over a number of years, and I felt like that the American people were not being told the truth in Washington about energy. I later decided it wasn't that somebody was lying, it was somebody that didn't know. And they talked about things they didn't know anything about, and what they were conveying to the public was things that were just not correct. And so I thought, well, I'm 80 years old. I understand the problem. I've got it well analyzed. I know what the solution is. And nobody else seems to have a plan. So I showed up on July 8th of 2008 with a plan. And to date, I am the only person in America with an energy plan.
In which you say that we can generate 20% of the energy that we use.
I couldn't hear you.
I said, you say with this plan we can generate 20% of the energy we use.
Well, that was the wind. the wind will do that in the wind corridor from Texas to Canada. That'll be 200,000 megawatts of wind, which will be 20% of our power generation in America. That can be accomplished by 2010. But my centerpiece of what I'm doing is to reduce the dependency on foreign oil. And the way we do that is to use a resource we have in America, which is natural gas. Natural gas and diesel are the only thing that'll move 18-wheelers. Nothing else. There's no battery. There's not a fuel cell. There's not anything else that'll do it. So we have an abundance of natural gas in America. It's a cleaner fuel by 80% than diesel. And so I want to switch all the trucks in America over to natural gas. If we do that, we will reduce dependency on foreign oil by 30 to 50%.
Well, as you say, the Pickens plan focuses on natural gas and wind power, and those are two industries that you've invested in. How much do you stand to gain if America adopts an energy mix that includes a lot more natural gas and wind?
Well, wind is a very risky business, and so that anybody can get in the wind business that wants to. So it's I'm not going to go in anything I don't expect to make money.
Well, why is it risky? I know when I've looked at the array of windmills outside of Palm Springs, I've been unimpressed, mainly because most of the windmills don't seem to be spinning their propellers.
Well, that tells you it's risky, that if you're not generating power, you're not making any money.
So why do you think that this wind array that you plan to put up, the largest wind farm in Texas, would be any different?
Well, we've measured the wind and believe we have adequate wind to make an investment that will make a profit. It's that simple. And so, and that my commitment in there, my first step on it, was 1,000 megawatts, which was $2 billion. That is risky. There's no cinch in that. But if you're going to put it up, you expect to make money. But I didn't go in this and make money. I've got enough money. I don't need to be out trying to sell this to make more money. But second, I don't own any natural gas. I am in the natural gas fueling business.
Is part of the risk the infrastructure that's needed to do this?
The infrastructure for wind?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to have transmission lines. There's a lot of things that are going to have to fall in place for that. And it's going to happen, but it doesn't happen very fast.
And you said that you're not really in this for the money because you have enough money. So is your concern environmental? Is it national security? Is this an economic issue?
Well, what I'm doing here is for the country. This has to be done. Somebody has got to bring attention to the fact that we are importing almost 70% of our oil. And if we go forward 10 years like we have gone for the last 40 years, we have no energy plan. The country's never had an energy plan. So the next 10 years, go fast forward to 2018, we will be importing 75% of our oil, and we'll be paying $300 a barrel for it. So we'll be broke at that point. So I thought, well, I'm the only one that has analyzed the problem, and I'm the only one that has a solution. So it's being what I consider to be a good patriotic American, it's my place to stand up and do the job. So that's my mission.
Are local governments cooperating with this project?
Yeah, everybody cooperates. I don't have anybody that doesn't.
And do you think that you were helped to some degree by when Al Gore raised awareness of some of these problems?
Well, Al and I are in good communication. His problem is global warming. And that's page two for me. Page one is to get the cost of foreign oil down and keep the money at home, and that'll create jobs, it'll make profits, it'll pay taxes, and make the economy go. And two, the security angle of mine is that we cannot afford to import 70% of our oil because it is a huge security problem for America. Now, and I told Al, I said, Al, if I get my page one done, I'll help you on page two to work on global warming.
Well, you've also spoken to John McCain and Barack Obama about your plan. John McCain really campaigned heavily for, nuclear power. Is that part of your plan?
Yes, everything American is part of my plan. I want everything American. I don't want any foreign oil.
Well, is it possible for us to become totally energy independent?
No, it probably isn't. And we import from Canada and Mexico and the UK about 29% of the oil we use every day. That oil is safe, secure, and those are good opportunities for us to use those resources. I don't want to import 50% of the oil from the Mideast and Africa, which is what we do.
But you're also not an admirer of biofuel. Wouldn't that also help us to become more energy independent?
No, I'm for biofuels.
Oh, you are?
I'm for anything American. You can't name it. If it takes place in America, I'm for it.
Mike, go ahead.
See, you take Senator Obama. He has said in 10 years we will not be importing any oil from the Mideast. And I believe him. That can be accomplished. But the only fuel you have that can accomplish that is natural gas.
And we'll get to that in just a moment. My guest is T. Boone Pickens. His latest book, The First Billion Is the Hardest, Reflections on a Life of Comebacks and America's Energy Future. It is published by Crown Business. You started investing heavily in natural gas around 2002. What did you see that others were missing?
I don't know. I'd been in the business so long and had the experience I did, and I did make a lot of money out of investing in natural gas. I was investing on a commodity market is where it was.
But natural gas investments hurt your first company, Mesa, didn't they?
That's right. They did, because my projections were way too early.
So it was just a matter of timing?
That's right. It was just a matter of timing.
Would a natural gas pipeline in Alaska be a big step forward in the for the natural gas industry and the Pickens plan?
A pipeline from the Arctic Coastal Plain down to the lower 48, we need to do that. And that's good, because that's a resource that America should use. Remember again, the natural gas is only a bridge for 20 to 30 years.
Because we'll run out of those reserves as well.
That's exactly right. And you're going to have to be over to the next generation of transportation fuel.
Does natural gas continue to be a good investment even during the economic downturn?
I'm not in a rush to get in anything right now. And so I don't know how low everything's going to go.
Now, you said that you were going to build the world's largest wind farm in Texas, but in Wednesday's Arizona Republic, there's a story that you've announced that it's on hold for the time being.
No, that story was not interpreted accurately. What it is with the financing here in the country, you can't borrow any money. It's hard to get any credit, and so it slowed us down. But we still will start receiving those turbines in 2010, and when we do, we've got to put them up.
Why do you think your commitment to our energy crisis has surprised so many people?
Well, because nobody ever had an energy plan. There's never been an energy plan. I have people come up to me all over the country now, and they say, thank you for coming up with an energy plan for the country.
I guess people are a little cynical, and they see you as doing this mainly to make more money, which you say you're not interested in.
I haven't run into any cynical attitudes.
Oh, good. Is solar power solar power should be a part of this mix as well, is it?
Absolutely, yes. Solar power has to be used.
And haven't you also invested heavily in water rights in Texas?
I have. Yes, I have.
Is all of that water in the Ogallala Aquifer?
Yes, it is.
What happens when that aquifer gets depleted?
When what?
When that aquifer gets depleted.
Well, see, the Ogallala extends from Midland, Texas, to the South Dakota border, and it's been under active use for irrigation. And so I'm in an isolated area in the northeast part of the Texas Panhandle, where four counties are kind of cut off from the rest of the aquifer. So the drainage that has gone on for years, for 50 years, we have not experienced that. We're also in an area where we're in rolling hills. So you would look at our water as stranded and surplus water. So we will sell 50% of our water and not take the reservoir down any lower than that. When over in the irrigated area, they've taken the water down to 10 or 20% remaining in the reservoir. They've reduced it by 70 or 80%. We won't do that. Ours will be better managed than anything that's ever happened in the Ogallala.
Still, the sense is that we are really using up all these non-renewable resources, water, natural gas, petroleum, and it's kind of scary for the future, isn't it?
Well, you're dealing with finite resources. That's why I say we won't draw down the Ogallala in those four counties below 50%. So we will, all we're doing is selling surplus water. That will recharge into the reservoir.
You're always described as an oil man. Should we stop calling you an oil man?
Yeah, I don't want to be called a gas man.
You've been
okay. I've got to take another call.
Oh, you're saying goodbye?
Yeah, I've got to tell you goodbye.
Okay, well, goodbye, T. Boone Pickens.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, T. Boone Pickens, his book, The First Billion is the Hardest, Reflections on a Life of Comebacks and America's Energy Future. It is published by Crown Business. Before he hung up so precipitously, I was about to ask T. Boone Pickens about his contributions to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth in 2004 and why he's no longer as involved in Republican politics. It's too bad I didn't get a chance to ask him that because he hung up on me.